Nelson, I live in Eden, North Carolina, and I'm here today with Colonel Robert K. Morgan, the pilot of the Memphis Belle, as well as Dauntless Dottie. And we're here to interview Colonel Morgan about his experiences in World War II. And I'd like to start by asking you, Colonel, if you would, just for the record, your name and where you were born and where you were reared.
Well, Robert K. Morgan, and I was born right here in Asheville, North Carolina, July 31st,
1918. 1918. And you were reared here, I take it?
Yes, except for the time I was in the military.
I see.
I stayed, lived here, still do live here.
Uh-huh. So, when you entered the service then, you were an Asheville resident, I take it, or had you gone off to college, or...?
Well, I went to college. I went to the University of Pennsylvania. But in 1940, after I had 2 years at university, I was quite a student of history.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty well convinced that the United States was going to be in World War II sooner or later. And so I started thinking, where does Bob Morgan want to enter into this picture before he go to war? I couldn't swim very well, so I didn't think I wanted to be in the Navy. And didn't think crawling on the ground was too great an idea. That kind of left me one place to be up in the sky. I had not been one of these guys that hung around the airports and wanted to fly and all that. I'd been in an airplane one time in my life, a DC-3 from Philadelphia to Washington. My dad gave me for a birthday present. You know, it was different, unusual, but it didn't keep me going out, boy, I want to go out and start flying all myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided in late 40, 1940, that I would take a crack at it and see if I could pass the physical first. So I applied and they sent me to Langley Field, Virginia, to take the physical. Well, it's an unusual thing that happened to me when I was taking that physical. I seemed to pass everything until I got to my eyes. And the flight surgeon took my eye test and he came back in and I could tell from his face that he wasn't too happy. He said, Morgan, said, your right eye is fine, you got 20/20 vision in it. Your left eye doesn't quite come up to 20/20. And as you know, we don't take anybody that doesn't have 20/20. And of course, my face kind of dropped, and he thought I was unhappy about it. And he said, I'll tell you what you do. You wait here in a minute. We were in a dark room. He said, I'll be back. So he came back in about 5 minutes, and he had a bag in his hand. He said, here's an ice bag. Put that on your left eye and hold it on there for about 10 minutes, and I'll be back. I put it on my left eye and held it, and he came in and wiped the water off, took my test, and I passed the 20/20. So that was my first big good luck piece.
I see.
So I was accepted, and now...
What time frame was this, Colonel Morgan?
This was in late November of 1940.
40, okay.
So. Yeah. And I was ready, gung-ho. But I didn't get any orders, sat around the house waiting on orders and didn't get them. And I called and they said, well, we don't have enough training bases to start training all the boys that are applied and we don't have enough instructors. They gave me all kinds of excuses. But you'll hear from them. And I think the only time I ever used any political influence, my dad was a good friend of Robert Reynolds, who was congressman, senator,
mm-hmm.
who happened to be chairman of the Military Affairs Committee in Washington. So I went to Dad and I said, why don't you call up your friend Bob Reynolds? Maybe he can jag this thing along a little bit, do something. He called him and 2 weeks later I got my orders to report to Camden, South Carolina for primary training. So I reported in January of 41, Camden. Now, they didn't have but one flying officer, military man. All the rest of the gentlemen there were, instructors were civilian. They had to take them because they didn't have enough to go around. So I always remember my first flight under my instructor. It was a PT-17 biplane, and put me in the back end of the cockpit, and we went up for kind of an orientation flight. Well, we did spins, rolls, snap rolls, slow rolls, echelons, and about the time of, I've been doing that for about 30 minutes, I didn't know whether I was ready for the Army Air Corps or not. But when I got back down on the ground, he said, "How'd it go?" I said, "Well, I'm a little dizzy, but I guess it's all right." Didn't tell him the whole truth. I was scared to death. But I said, "Look, if you got in this thing, gonna go through it." Well, it took me a little longer than some of the guys to solo. Took about 6.5 hours of time. Finally soloed. And after we'd spent 3 or 4 more hours instructing, my instructor, Earl Friedel, said, "Morgan, I want to see you tonight after reply. Come back in the back of the hangar, we want to talk." I remember that very well. He said, "Look," he said, "I don't think you really appreciate what the government's doing for you. He said, they're supposed to spend about $30,000 training you, and I don't think you really got into it." He said, "Let me tell you how I learned to fly. I used to hang around in airports. I was a country boy, lived on a farm, didn't have any money. Guys took pity on me, took me up an airplane, showed me the maneuvers and that. And I'd go home at night and sit on the back porch with a broomstick in my hand and practice the maneuver."
Ah, yes.
And he said, "That's the way I learned to fly." And he said, "I really came the hard way. If you don't straighten up and throw more enthusiasm and get with the program, I may have to wash you out." And washing out, of course, means you're through in the pilot training.
Right.
Well, I woke up, got through primary school, and I had one little incident, though, that happened to me in primary school. It's kind of interesting because it kind of portrays the rest of my military life in the Army Air Corps. As we got ready to transfer us to basic training in Augusta, Georgia, Bush Field, had all the records, and they happened to go through my record to recheck it, and it was 30 minutes short of the flying time, and you had to have the total flying time. So we had one lieutenant there, he was over the base. He said, "Morgan," said, "you go out there, everybody else was finished, go out there and get one of the steermen, go up and fly 30 minutes, and we'll log it, and then you'll be finished." Beautiful day. Well, I got in it, and I went up and flew for about 25 minutes, and it was just beautiful, just doing a few maneuvers now. And I came back over the field, and all these PT-17s were all lined up two rows. And I don't know what happened, but I decided to go down and buzz the field. I came down across the field about 100 feet above the steerman. When I landed, I had a greeting committee with the lieutenant and my flight instructor. And boy, they were mad. Said a few choice words to me. He said, "Morgan," Lieutenant Hugland, he's still alive, I remember him well. He said, "Morgan, if it wasn't for the fact that your orders had all been set through and the record is finished now, I'd wash you out right now. But I'm going to tell you something, if you ever do a stunt like this while you're in the Army Air Corps, you will get kicked out." Yes, sir.
Very.
So then I went to Bush Field at Augusta, and we had BT-13s. Which was an upgraded airplane. The only thing it didn't have, it had a lot of more speed and it had a closed cockpit, but you also were going to get instrument flying, and the wheels didn't retract. But that was the only thing that was made it different than a AT-6. Well, at Bush Field, I behaved myself pretty well. But at the end of the training at Bush Field, which was in July of 1941, I found out that I was a little slow in some, not the flying part of it, but the ground school, particularly navigation. I was very poor in navigation. And they offered you, when you graduated from Bush, whether you wanted fighters or bombers. And of course, this was a big decision. And I chose bombers, much to the surprise of all my friends. Because they said that wild Morgan who used to drive his daddy's Buick around those mountains 110 miles an hour would cut to been a fighter pilot. I mean, you know, being a bomber. Why did I choose bombers? Three reasons. One is I found myself with a poor navigator. I need to navigate. So bombers got to navigate. The second reason is I didn't want to be up there by myself. Third is I wanted more than one engine. So they gave me bombers.
I see. So you volunteered for bombers.
Right.
And I understand the reason why. I think I kind of can relate to that. Well, anyway, continue on then.
Then we went to Bushfield, incidentally, was also a civilian base with the military over the top, but all the instructors were civilian. Then they sent me to Barksdale Field, Shreveport, Louisiana, which was a military base and a training base for advanced training. Well, you expected to get there and have some nice, new, beautiful airplanes, bombers, but we didn't have anything like that. Had some old beat-up planes, B-11s, B-10s, B-13s, and believe me, they didn't look like they were still capable of flying, but that's what we started training in. We only had one modern airplane that was really there, the Lockheed Hudson, which was a twin-engine airplane. It only had one disadvantage for a training plane. It only had one set of controls. So the instructor and the student had to share one set of controls, the yoke, and pass it back and forth across the...
Flip back and forth.
Yeah, it's flipped back and forth. Which makes it kind of difficult because if you've gotten any problems, you really needed the instructor to take over. You might have a little problem.
Right.
And we had a few problems with Lockheed Hudson. It was a what we call a ground looping airplane. And when it would ground loop, normally the landing gear would break off up into the wing. And that's where the gas tanks were. Mm-hmm. And we lost a couple of them. Fortunately, I didn't have any bad situations there. Went through advanced training. And we were to graduate December 12th, 5 days after Pearl Harbor, at Barksdale Field. And you had to take one more physical. And it was kind of ironic because when the flight surgeon took the physical, got to my eyes again, and he came to me, and I told him the whole story. He laughed. He said, "Well, that's a new one on me." He said, "I could wash you out if you want me to. You can go back to civilian training, make a lot of money being a civilian instructor,
right,
or I can send you on through." I said, "Well, we got this far, might as well go on." So I graduated on the 12th of December of 1941, got my gold second lieutenant bars in my wings. They sent me off to MacDill Field, Tampa, Florida. I got in MacDill. We actually reported there in January of 42, and the only airplane they had for multi-engine was the Lockheed Hudson, which was, of course, I was very well qualified in that. As a matter of fact, I spent a lot of my time checking out majors and captains, because they hadn't been checked out in the Lockheed. But they had it there, and they started to use it for submarine patrol in the Gulf of Mexico. They thought they might get some submarines in the... We never saw one, but we still went out and hunted and looked for them every day for 2 or 3 months. Here's again an incident that will show by some kind of a distinguished part of my aviation career again. One Sunday afternoon, we were a beautiful Sunday afternoon, we were patrolling the shores of St. Petersburg and that whole area, Clearwater, out in the Gulf. And I came back over to St. Petersburg Beach. Does that bother you? St. Petersburg Beach, and saw a big party down on the beach. I thought I'd go down and take a close look at it. And I made a pass about 500 feet off of the beach. Then I came down a little lower, made another pass, considerably lower. Well, I didn't think a thing about it. The next morning I walked into the squadron commander's officer corps for duty. He looked very sternly at me and said, "Morgan, General Olds would like to see you in his office." And I hadn't had the pleasure of meeting General Olds. But I went over and reported to General Olds, and he looked very sternly at me and said, "Morgan," he said, "would you fly Lockheed Hudson number so-and-so yesterday afternoon?" "Yes, sir." "Did you happen to buzz a cocktail party that I was at?"
"Oh, what?"
"I didn't know you were at it, sir." Well, anyway, he hadn't smiled a bit. He said, "You know, I'd kick you out of the Army Air Corps right now, except we hadn't spent so much money on you. And I hear you're a pretty good pilot. So I'm going to let you stay in, but I'm going to tell you this. If I have my way, you'll be the oldest second lieutenant in the Army Air Corps." "Yes, sir." Anyway, I went back and we then got the B-24 Liberators in. Big Liberator. Of course, it was a huge airplane.
Right.
Had a lot of names. The Liberator, the boxcar. It looked like a boxcar. But of course, not having seen anything else of that size, I thought it was something. And we started training in it. And I got about 60 hours in the Liberator. Had orders cut. Send me to Africa in the Liberator. And a day before it was supposed to leave MacDill, they changed the orders, took us first pilots, which I was at that time in the Liberator, took us out, moved the co-pilots over, gave them another pilot, sent them to Africa, and left us back at MacDill. 2 weeks later, I saw the prettiest airplane I've ever seen then and since, the B-17, the Flying Fork.
Right.
And they brought it into MacDill, and we started training in the B-17. And of course, after flying the Liberator, and I must say, this was such fun and great flying characteristics of the 17, fell in love with it immediately.
So you enjoyed the B-17 more than flying the B-24?
It was fun to fly. I mean, you had to work to fly the 24. 17 was so easy on the controls, and the wing, entirely different wing. Liberator had the Davis wing, which was kind of a flat, wide wing. I always said the B-17 looked like a bird. It wanted to fly, and the wings looked like a bird. So we started training, doing our cross countries, doing our simulated bomb runs, doing aerial gunnery practice, and started to formulate our crews in the spring of 42. Mm-hmm. We did cross-country flights, but we had one instruction on our cross-country flights that we could not land anywhere. Well, it had to be a complete 360 degree, come back to the base. Couldn't land anywhere we wanted to. Mm-hmm. We'd go to the cities, fly over. Again, I got in a slight bit of trouble. I decided one day to fly up to Asheville, North Carolina, my hometown, and kind of fly over the city and let the people know what a B-17 looked like, because I know they'd never seen one.
Right.
And I paid all regulations, flew 1,500 feet over the city and did try it at a low level. But as I was coming away from the city, I saw the local airport. And gee whiz, you know, that's a nice airport. I know he told me not to land, but I'm going to land anyway. And it was only a 4,000 foot runway where we'd have 6,000 feet in the deal. I landed and burnt out my brakes. So I had to make a very embarrassing phone call back to the base and called the squadron commander and told him what had happened. And after he said a few choice words, he said, "We'll send a crew up, Morgan, and change the brakes and come on back to the base." They did. I came back to the base, and he never mentioned a word about that incident at that time. 3 weeks later, we got orders to transfer to Walla Walla, Washington to do our second phase training and supposedly our last training before we'd go overseas. And all of us went into the operations office and had a blackboard showing what airplane you were to fly to Walla Walla, the number and all that. My name was not up there by any airplane. I asked the operations officer, I said, "What goes on here?" He said, "Well," he said, "Morgan, you better go and talk to squadron commander." So I did, and Major Smeltzer, I went in and said, "Major, my name's not on the blackboard. What airplane am I flying?" He said, "Morgan," he said, "remember that little incident that you landed at Asheville, North Carolina?" "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, you're not flying an airplane to Walla Walla. You're riding the troop train." Oh. So I was the only pilot that probably ever rode the troop train from one end of the country to the other.
I see.
It was kind of embarrassing.
No doubt.
So we went to Walla Walla, started our final phase training in the fall, in the summer and fall of 42. And I guess the only major incident that happened to me while I was in Walla Walla, our flight surgeon's wife came out to visit him, and she was from Memphis, Tennessee. She brought her sister with her to visit, and Margaret Pope. And I started dating Margaret Pope while she was in Walla Walla.
Right.
And that's a lead to something else in the future.
Yes,
we trained in Walla Walla, and in September of 42, we got brand new B-17Fs. And we went to Bangor, Maine to do our shakedown flights on these brand new 17Fs and see if they'd be sure they were in good condition, ready to go to Europe. And while training there and shaking down the airplane, everybody started naming their airplane and putting a name on it. And I got the 10 crew members, 10 of us, together, and I said, "Look, guys, we got to name this airplane. What do you got? Any good ideas?" Well, we had 10 guys and 10 different ideas. And I brought up the name of the Memphis Belle. I said, "You know, that sounds like a pretty good name." They said, "Oh, just because you're dating that girl from Memphis, you don't want to name it after that." I said, "What's that? That ain't got any relationship to it." I said, "Well, 10 ideas, what are we going to do?" We said, "Well, sleep on it and talk about it tomorrow." That night, I took my tail gunner out to a beer joint, Johnny Quinlan. Johnny and I got to talk about a lot of things, and I brought up the name of the airplane. I said, "Johnny, don't you think a Memphis Belle is a pretty good idea?" "No, that doesn't sound too good. Chief," they call me Chief, all the crew members. And I said, "Well, we'll have a couple more beers." We had a couple more beers. And after about the third beer, I said, "Johnny, really, seriously, I'd like to name him." "Well, Chief, if that's what you want to do, I'll go along with it." Next day, we had 2 votes to Memphis Belle and 8 other votes for other names.
Other things.
So the majority won.
So the majority won by 2 to...
Yeah.
By 2 votes.
So at this time, there was a magazine, which is still printed today, Esquire magazine, and there was a gentleman, an artist in there named Petty. And I'd read that magazine, Esquire, like other people had. There were some beautiful girls in there. I called him on the phone and I told him I wanted a painting if he'd give me one. He was very obliging, said he'd be glad to. Sent me a painting. We had a pretty good artist in our group, and he painted the bell on both sides of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I always get the question asked, why was the blue bathing suit on one side and the red bathing suit on the other? I said, well, he wanted to do that, and I said, as long as you put a bathing suit on her, I don't care what color you put. So anyway, that's how the airplane got her name. We were doing cross-country shakedown flights. We flew down to Memphis, broke a bottle of champagne over the nose of the airplane, christened the Memphis Belle. And in October of 1942, we got in our 91st, we formed the 91st group, which I was a part of, 324th Squadron. And the group had 36 B-17s, four squadrons, and 9 airplanes per squadron, 3 flights. Mm-hmm. And I was a flight leader at that time. I had a wingman on my right, winger on my left, and 3 flights. We flew the North Atlantic and landed in Scotland. Went on down to England, and the British were building bases real fast for us. We had a brand new training base, would be a combat base, we hope, and Quonset huts and all that, but the British didn't build the runways quite strong enough for, in our particular case, we tore up the runway. And of course, lucky as we would have it, we had to go look for another base. Now, Colonel Stanley Ray, told by General Laker to go out and see if he could find a base that wasn't being used, and if it was, well, we could probably get permission to use it. He looked around and he found an old English base was not being used. Total empty. Beautiful base. Beautiful homes on it. Full hangars. No Quonset huts. All and just beautiful base. Colonel Ray took it upon himself to move us before he called the general. Then called the general. Called General Ecker and said, sir, we found a base. Yeah, where'd you find it, Colonel? Bassingbourne. He said, isn't that, hey, let me look that up. He said, I'll be back with you. He looked it up and then called him back and said, by the way, that's an English base. You can't take an English base without their permission. I don't think they'll give you permission. He said, well, we've already moved. He said, you've already moved? Yes. He said, well, I'll tell you what, till they kick you out, stay there.
Ah.
Well, make a long story short, we ended up with the nicest base in England of anybody in the 8th Air Force. People came to visit from all over. All the VIPs all came to our base because they didn't have to sleep in Quonset huts. And we had a good, nice officer's quarters and officer's pub and all that. So we ended up at Bassingbourne.
How many planes were quartered at Bassingbourne?
Well, there was only the 91st group, our 36 airplanes.
36 planes.
4 squadrons. Mm-hmm. That's all they had. Each base had one group. Mm-hmm. And we did run a few practice missions. And on November 7th, we ran our first combat mission on the submarine pens of Brest, France. You got to get the picture that this daylight strategic bombing, nobody knew anything about doing it. It had never been tried before.
Right.
There'd been no books written about it. The generals didn't know any more than our second lieutenant. And incidentally, I might add, I told you I was a flight leader. And I was the only flight leader that was still the second lieutenant. The general's word had gotten through. All the rest of them were first lieutenant at this point. Anyway, we're going to bomb 26 to 27,000 feet. By the time we got our 9 airplanes off the ground and started to climb, got to bombing altitude, instead of having 36 airplanes, we only had 18. The rest of them had turned back. Mechanical problems, frozen guns, frozen fingers. A lot of problems that we hadn't anticipated that we got into. We bombed Brest, France. Did a fair job on the submarine pen. Didn't lose any airplane. Saw a few fighters. Few bullet holes in the airplane. Nobody got wounded on any of the crew. And I remember sitting around when we got back from that first mission and everybody said, gee whiz, you know, this is not so bad. I mean, you know, we're all concerned about the fighters and the flag, and we saw a lot of it, and had a little damage, but nothing serious. You know, if we keep on like this, all of them are like this, we get those over in a hurry. We found out in the next mission, we went down to Saint-Nazaire submarine fans in southern France, and we had a rough time, lost two airplanes in our group, and got shot up pretty bad. Our airplane had some damage, we had one engine shot out from flak, and our tunes were quite different that evening mm-hmm. when we got back. Well, as I said, everything was trial and error. Formation types we were forming, we tried different types of formation, we tried different altitudes. The generals decided that maybe we could fool the Germans. We'd been bombing those first two missions at 26 and 27,000 feet. Maybe if we went down on the deck, right on the water, our big job was submarine pens, and they told us that's what you're going to be doing in France. We need to knock out these submarine pens right. So they don't get our ships that are bringing supplies and troops. So they said, let's try a low-level mission. Go down right on the deck, stay under their radar. They won't know we're coming until we're over the target. And we're going to bomb Saint-Nazaire. You're going to hear that word more down.
Yes, I saw that.
And we'll go right down, and before we get to the target, we'll pull up at that 4,000 or 5,000 feet bomb, be out there before the fighters get off the ground, before the flak batteries can get set up. We'll really get out. Didn't work that way. Got the daylight shot out of us that day. I got shot up pretty bad. I had my right wing shot up, knocked off a big 4.5 feet of the right wing. We lost three airplanes in our squadron that day. Five total in our group. Lost the squadron commander that day, who was leading our particular squadron. They never tried another low-level mission. We went back to high altitude.
Let me ask a question. This low-level, actually daylight bombing, was quite a departure from what the English had been doing, is it not?
Yes, and the English tried to discourage us to doing it. They said, we've tried it. You can't do it. It won't work. The fighters are too tough in the daylight, and the flak is too accurate. And as a matter of fact, they originally tried to get us to join them and bomb at nighttime and do what they're doing, area bombing instead of strategic bombing. And as a matter of fact, they had a lot of discussion about that. And General Acker, who was head of the 8th Air Force, had to go down and talk to Winston Churchill and convince him to let us try, because otherwise we would have been at night bombing. So he told us to go ahead and try. But again, as I said, it was a trial and error basis. Formation flying changed a lot. But we had some guys that had some good thinking. Doolittle was over there at that time, and there was a gentleman by the name of Curtis LeMay.
Mm-hmm.
Was also over there, and
right.
they had some good ideas about different types of formations. And you got to remember, the formation was so important from the fighter standpoint. We did not have fighter escort. We didn't have any airplanes that could go on that length of mission. And the British would send their Spitfires out till we reached the French coast, and then they wave us goodbye. We were on our own. And Hitler had said, you'll never bomb Germany in daylight. You'll never bomb Germany in daylight. He quoted that way and said. So he set up his best fighters. Abbeville boys were one of the hottest groups of fighters he had. And most of them were the Focke-Wulf 190s. And the Callan was painted yellow. We called them the Yellow Nose Boys, and they were good. They weren't scared of coming in head-on or in the rear or whatever.
Which fighter?
We had the...
Messerschmitt or the 109?
We had
the 190 was the more dangerous.
Well, you had the 190, but you all had the 109, mm-hmm. Messerschmitt. And they were one just as bad as the other, mm-hmm. as far as we were concerned. We hated to see either one of them. And they really sent them in swarms. To give you an example, the first 3 months of our combat tour, our group, the 91st group, lost 82% of the original guys that flew the North Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Now, we had replacement crews coming in, but we lost 82% of our original crew.
The odds of somebody making 25 missions intact then was very,
very, very slight, and morale was not the best. That's when the generals came out and said, if you do finish 25 missions, you can go home. Mm-hmm. So they put that little carrot out in front of us and
right.
said, and, you know, some name it. During our tour of duty, I had 9 engines shot out. I had that part of my right wing shot off. I had 6 feet of tail stabilizer shot off. And we still came home. And we had hundreds of bullet holes and hundreds of flak holes. The airplane, they replaced so much of the parts. The airplane didn't look like its original self at all.
How physically demanding was it for you as a pilot to control your aircraft in that type of situation?
Well, that's the amazing part of the B-17. Even when we lost part of our right wing or the stabilizer, that airplane still could have control of it. I mean, it's only one time we had an engine fire that we really thought we were going to get real trouble. And we put the damn engine fire out by diving the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
We were away from our formation at that time. We were slowed down. Somebody else had to take my flag, and we were out there by ourselves, which is a bad thing to be,
yes.
particularly with a fighter. And I say we dove about 6,000 feet to get to, and it mainly put out the fire. But the airplane was amazing how it would handle. If you had little rudder control, you could over control the ailerons and use your engines to control the turns. It was a fantastic, amazing airplane. I saw them shot up a lot worse than I was and came home. Came home on 2 engines, many a time.
Let's just digress a second, and if you would, tell me what a typical day was like when you went on a mission. What time did you get up in the morning? What was the routine that you went through?
Usually you had a wake-up call if there was a mission around 6 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
and give you time to get dressed and get over to briefing, have breakfast afterwards.
What was the briefing like?
The briefing was for the navigators, bombardiers, pilots. The enlisted men had their separate briefing from a gunnery part standpoint. We went into the target map, the formation was all on the blackboard, who was leading what flight, which flight was leading the whole squad, whole group, and the intelligence gave us information on the target, a report on what to expect in the way of anti-aircraft fire from that target, what route we would be taking and what fighter fields we'd be close to and expecting fighters to be picked up and crossing France, or if you're going the water route up the North Sea and coming in from the north, when you expect to be picked up with fighters, and how important the target was. And
you had an understanding then of actually the significance of the target.
You well, we knew of that. It was from an aircraft factory or an ammunition factory or what it was, or rail junctions. And you had 3 targets. You were given 3 targets, your primary target, your secondary, and then your last resort target.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were ordered never to just drop our bomb indiscriminately. We were told not to bomb cities,
mm-hmm.
only strategic targets, and all 3 of these targets would be strategic. And if you couldn't get your bombs on any one of those targets because of cloud cover, and we had to have visual contact,
right?
Because we didn't have radar bombing. Bring your bombs home. That was an order. And only one time I had to break my palms.
Another question on the strategy of attacking these targets to minimize the opposition. Were there things that Bomber Command did to maximize your results yet minimize the opposition?
Well, at the very beginning, we were allowed pretty much freedom to do slight maneuvers. When I say slight maneuver, being a flight leader, I would be doing the maneuver and my wingman had to follow me.
Getting back to what we were saying there, the strategy of some of these bombing raids to, in effect, avoid some of the opposition that you might otherwise expect.
Well, being a flight leader, I have the important point of making any maneuvers that we made slight or great, and I had to be very careful because we flew very tight formation, so tight. That sometimes my right wing man or my left wing man would be overlapping part of my tip of my wing. That's how close it was. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to avoid any crashes and putting them in a tough spot, I had to make slow maneuvers and gradually make a turn. And particularly turn into the man that's on your left wing and the right wing man could come in. And the importance of this tight formation was against the fighters because we could put out an awful lot of firepower if we were formation was tight or stacked up and down. So most of the fighters came in from head on or top on. And when we'd see them coming, I would make a slight maneuver, not over 10 or 15 degree bank, and maybe drop 100 feet or come up on it just to throw them off enough as they were calling out, as gunners were calling out where they were coming from. I'd try to turn away from them like that. We had to be very careful about this because in the very beginning, we did two greater maneuvers.
Turn tape now.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side one. The interview continues on tape A, side two.
Okay.
We had to be very careful because of formation. But at the very beginning, the generals, as I said, didn't know any more than we did, and we made some drastic maneuver. And it threw the formation out of kilter. The guys would either have to pull away or we had a close borders were too close for collision. And we actually lost airplanes from collision. Not so many while I was there, but when they got up to where they had 500, 600 airplanes in the air, they had some problems with formation flying. But I had to be extremely careful not to turn in my right wing man, who was usually up above me, my left wing man, who was just slightly below me. And so I couldn't make drastic maneuvers. Now, this was against the fighters. On the bomb run, we also started to do a little maneuvers in the beginning. General Laker put out an order after our bombing wasn't so accurate. This had to stop. Straight and level on bomb runs completely. Turned, and we were originally, the pilot still flew the airplane on the bomb run. That was quit. He put it on automatic pilot, was hooked into the bomb site. The bombardier was flying the airplane when you were on the bomb run. And of course, his maneuvers were very slight, if he was as accurate as he's supposed to be. And this was the worst time in the world for a pilot. I could touch nothing.
Right.
I'm sitting up there like a dummy.
Did the bombardier actually have controls where he was able to fly the plane from his position?
He could fly it. He could maneuver it up or down, right and left. Mm-hmm. He had that complete control.
I see.
Anything the automatic pilot would do, he could do with that bomb sight.
Okay, let's, getting back then to kind of a typical day, you had breakfast, you had your briefing, and if you had a daylight, all your bombing runs were daylight runs, I assume.
That's right.
So you'd have a daylight run, and what time normally would the planes tend to take off?
This would depend entirely on the weather conditions. As you can imagine, the Germans didn't send us any weather report, so we didn't know what the weather was over there. And our poor weathermen had to completely rely on what was over England, plus what had gone through the day before, and normally the weather traveling from west to east, that would be over the continent the next day. So some of it was guesswork. There were reconnaissance flights, and also the British, who were bombing at night, would give us some information as to what they had encountered the night before if they'd been on a mission over some area. So they get some feed in. But it was very difficult. So they might have wanted to take off at 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock, but they had to be sure. So we were in limbo a great deal of time. We set a time, sometimes we'd have to step down. In other words, they'd call, not call the mission off, but delay it. But most of the time it was on time. You went out to your airplanes, after the briefing, after you had breakfast after that, and any leisure, because they had religious services, and the gentleman wanted to go to religious service. You got in your Jeep, and all 10 of you went out to your airplane. Your crew chief had checked your airplane thoroughly, had run up the engines, and did all the pre-flight. So you didn't do that. The pilot did not do any pre-flight.
You did not have to do, did you do any visual check at all of the plane?
Only, you went around and looked just to be sure nothing happened, since he'd done his pre-flight a couple of hours ago.
Right.
Somebody sabotaged it or something, which was not likely with our base. But you did, you checked it. Then you got together as a group, and the crew of the Memphis Belle, every guy had his own pilot had his own way. But we gathered around and we talked and remembered to look for the fighters, call out the fighters, and don't tie up the intercom with unnecessary conversation. Call the fighters out, call, see any planes going down, or you see any damaged airplanes or anything, remember it. See any fighters shot down, report it, because you had to report those, or you wouldn't get credit for them. And then we had a little thing in the Memphis Belle. Guys, I said, look, there's only one airplane coming back today. It's going to be us. Let's go out there with that positive attitude. And we climbed on the airplane. Don't know whether it did any good or not, but at least your mind was clear.
Right.
We felt good about it, and we felt positive. We didn't have, maybe it's going to be our turn today to get shot out, anything like that. We had a feel of positive, and I think it helped us mentally, if nothing else.
You got a signal from the tower then to start engines?
Well, yeah, the guy gave us start engines, and they did it by flights, because first flight, which would be the lead flight, going out first, and the second flight, so on. We being not only a flight leader, we led the group a number of times, and we led the whole 8th Bomber Command a number of times. So we had to form, after you took off, you had to form up with those other groups, which you'd been given in briefing. You could roll up with 8th, 100th group, or the 106th group, or the 197th group, or the 194th group. You're going to join up with them, and you'll be leading the whole pack, or you'll be falling in behind another group. That's why they had the designations painted on the airplane to show what group you were with, so you wouldn't get screwed up and get into the wrong group. Or
typically, how many planes would join up in a bomb run?
Well, of course, these were the early days. And we only had four groups over there at that time. And you didn't get all your 36 of each group out.
Were there any other bomb groups, or was yours?
Oh, yeah.
Literally
no, no. Matter of fact, we were the second group got over there.
Okay.
The 94th, I think, was the first group. I think it was the 94th.
But they were independent of you bombing their own targets?
No, they were. We'd all go on the same target.
All on the same target.
All on the same target. Later on, as they got more groups, they would pick out other diversion targets.
I see.
So they would kind of split up the fighter groups and that. But at the very beginning, we bombed, like, we started out, we bombed Brest, all of the groups. We bombed Saint-Nazaire, all the groups, until we started going into Germany, which was later on.
Mm-hmm.
We all bombed the same group.
Okay, you lined up on the runway, and you, how long did you typically have to wait before you could actually
take
off?
If you did it right, you're taking off every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
If you did it
so
right.
So you could clear the field pretty fast.
Clear the field fast, go to your zone, mm-hmm. what you were going to hover over, and bring your group into formation. And then your group leader would go in and with the other formations where you were supposed to fly, either the first group, or the second group, or the third group, or the fourth group, or the fifth group, what formation you were going to be in.
Typically, how long did it take for the planes to organize to the point where they're able to, you need to get that?
No.
Typically, how long did it take for the planes to organize to the point where they're able to fly towards the target?
Well, in the very beginning, where we would have four groups, you could get all them together in about 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were taking off from different airfields, so they were all in the air approximately the same time, the groups, and they would go to a particular zone and meet up with the other group.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. If you can recollect your feelings as you, particularly on that first mission to Brest, what were your feelings, both physical and emotional, as you took off in that first bomb run? Just the physical feeling of being in charge of that aircraft.
Well,
what was it like to push the throttle slower and so forth?
Well, you knew it wasn't another practice mission. It was the real thing, and of course, we had no idea what to expect. We talked to British pilots who had bombed in daylight, and they tried to bomb in daylight. And of course, if you listened to them much, you really didn't want to go on a mission. But it was anxiety mainly, particularly that first mission. I mean, here was something new, our whole career, our life. It's what we trained for months after months after months. And anticipation. We hadn't seen an airplane shot down. We didn't feel we were going to be shot down. We felt that we were going to do a mission and come home. And of course, the first mission gave us a little bit too much confidence. Came back, as I told you, and we were very confident in what we were going to do. And so you didn't have that anxiety. After the second mission, where you really saw an airplane shot down, and you came back and those guys weren't there that night for dinner,
right.
Then your attitudes changed entirely.
Yes.
You took an anxiety at the responsibility. Flight leader had a responsibility, but a pilot of a B-17, responsibility for those other nine guys in there. But it was a team effort and not just a one airplane, and you had to remember that. And the one thing they told you, if an airplane got shot up and was crippled, but still flying, had to leave the formation, you can't go up.
No.
You've got to stay in that formation. The formation is the most important thing. If you hadn't got the target, it's the most important you stayed to get, you did the bomb run. If you had left the target and was on the way home, you still couldn't leave that because you would risk the other crew, other people in that flight, because they would diminish the firepower that they had against the fighter. So you, that poor guy, you had to leave it. You watched him, you reported to the guys that bailed out, how many bailed out, so that you'd have that for deterioration for when they got back and they interrogated you. But all that information that had was important.
You know? Right. Typically, if a plane had to leave the formation, it was easy bait for the...
Oh, the fighters poured on.
Yeah.
If a plane left the formation, he was duck soup. I mean, fighters just not just one. I mean, they would swarm over to be sure that they shot him down.
Right. Okay, I want to talk about some of the other missions, but let me ask a couple other questions now. Your crew, you had 9 men plus you, 10?
Total
of 10 aboard the aircraft. What would be a typical bomb load, or what types of bombs would be used depending upon your target?
You used mostly 500-pound demolition bombs, which were supposed to penetrate most anything to hit. As I told you, we were bombing submarine pens greatly because that was big. And we had a tough time with those submarine pens because they were so well fortified in concrete. That's why we had to go back a number of times. Even though bombing was accurate, reasonably accurate, it still had to go back and back to really help destroy some of those submarine pens. And try to also, naturally, if there were any submarines in the pens, get them. And you could carry 10 to 15 500-pound bombs, depending on the range you were going, how much fuel you were taking, and that.
Did you ever have occasion to use other type of bombs?
No, we always used 500-pound.
Strictly those. Now, on your flight toward your target, what would be a typical speed that you would fly?
Well, of course, you were climbing all the time, because with the load you had on the 17, you were only climbing 200 or 300 feet a minute, maybe sometimes a little more, but it was very slow, and you wanted to be easy on your engines so you could overheat them. We were very fortunate, we had tough engines with the Wright engine, and we didn't lose many from mechanical failure at all. But your climb out was 140 to 160, depending on how many turns you were making, and that's indicated airspeed, mm-hmm. not ground speed.
Right.
And as I say, you climbed because you weren't getting to your depending on how distance of the target. Brest, France was a short way, mm-hmm. So you had to get up there faster than you had to circle some. Going down to Saint-Nazaire was a long haul, so you were climbing slower, and you were over water most of the time. You didn't pick up as many fighters on the way to the target. Mm-hmm. They all were mostly at the target. When we started bombing into Germany, and we're going into German targets like Bremen, which was inland quite a bit, you had a long haul over land, and of course you wanted to get to altitude as soon as you can, because down low you were not as good at condition to fight fighters as you were when you got up there and got in your real tight formation. Our bombing was very accurate. As you probably know, we bombed with the lead airplane in the group. In the group, kind of, it was, you got all the 36 out there. There were 36 in that group. You bombed on that bombardier. He was the only one that used his bomb sight. And all the other, if there were 35 others up there.
They dropped bombs upon the, they saw his release?
As soon as he released the air bombs, they started releasing.
I see.
Because his aiming point was supposed to be, if it was a factory, not the first part of the factory, but further down, so it would get an area, the whole area of that factory. Sometimes if you were bombing a rail junction, they would divide the group up, and you would, if you had 36, 18 would go to one part of the rail junction, and the other 18 the other part of the rail junction. So you get a good area of bombing of that particular.
So that lead bombardier then was critical.
And that's again why they wouldn't let you make any maneuvers over there. And it was, you know, it was a 30 seconds to 45 to a minute most. Of course, to me, it felt like an endless time.
Right.
But you had to be straight and level and no maneuvering at all.
Right.
And the German flak was so accurate, so very accurate.
Now, did you use any evasive maneuvers with the flak once you got off your bombing run itself?
Yes, but of course the flak, the main part of the flak you were over with, then you turned out as steep as you could with your formation, maybe a 30, 35 degree bank,
yeah,
and climb a few hundred feet to throw them off, because their flak was not all over the target, it was over the area of the target.
Right.
So there were flak batteries still shooting at you. So you try to change your altitude and your headings a number of times.
Yeah. Did you get more flak than approaching the target, or when you left, or was it equal?
Just before you got on the target, there was just as much flak as there was over the target. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Germans were they knew your maneuvers, they knew what you were doing. So they started as soon as you looked like you were getting ready to approach the target. So you had flak oncoming the target. And most of the fighter groups stayed away from you when you were over the
right.
They didn't want to get in that flak either.
Right.
There was a few daring ones that would still come in, but they sat up there, waited till you came out of that flak there, and then they really pounced on you.
Now, when you dropped your bombs, what was the physical sensation on the aircraft?
Wanted to climb, but you were all ready for it, and mm-hmm. If you didn't want it to climb, it didn't climb. Of course, you wanted to climb a little bit, but to get out of the area. But you didn't. If you let it go, it would have been a big sensation. But you had trimmed your trim tab and everything else, so that when the bombardier said bombs away, and that minute he turned loose of the control of the airplane, you were ready for him. You and the co-pilot too, so you'd be sure to hold it.
Would that be considered kind of a dangerous time then, right when you release the bombs due to the plane, reacting to the...
Yeah, but of course you wanted to react a certain amount. Mm-hmm. Of course, you want to get those bomb bay doors, so that slowed you down. You want to get them closed as quick as possible so you can get out of there.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, then on the way back, then, did you maintain altitude? Did you lose altitude?
It depended on, of course, how far you were away from Brest, France. We started lowering immediately away from the target because you weren't too far from the English coast. Mm-hmm. Depending on how far you're away from the English coast. Same as there. The sooner we could get down, we tried to get down. But the fighters were up at altitude, they were more maneuverable than we were.
Oh.
And we tried to get down where they had a disadvantage because they had a disadvantage at lower altitude.
Oh, I see.
Diving on us, particularly because they didn't want to go into the ground. We get down as low as we could, as soon as we could.
Okay, and then...
of course, picking up airspeed, too.
Typically, then, what speed would you be going back?
Well, we would have 160, 170, 175 indicated.
You'd be a little faster.
Yeah.
Because you're lighter. So.
Yeah. And of course, it depends on the condition of your airplanes, too.
Now, if you had to, of course, you had a fuel situation where you had to watch your fuel. You couldn't go too fast to burn too much fuel, I assume.
Well, until we started going into Germany and penetrating into Germany, our fuel was not the major concern. Mm-hmm. After we started hitting German targets and getting further away, then they started to fuel. But we had leaned the engines out, the fuel out, to maximum, so we didn't hurt the engine by overheating. We would keep the fuel as lean as we can, as long as we could. We were watching those gauges pretty closely. My co-pilot, that was his main job. Mm-hmm. I was too busy being careful for my wingman.
Sure.
And
coming back to base then, you had fighters, I assume, still active?
Well, fighters came pretty close to the English coast, but they didn't come across the channel. Mm-hmm. And of course, as soon as you found out what the condition of other airplanes were, you broke up as you came over the channel. If you didn't have any major problems or problem, you let all the ones that had major damage, wounded aboard, all that, and they used flares to show that they had that condition. You let them come on in ahead of you, and you came on in after.
And after you landed then, what was the routine then?
Get out of the airplane, go to debriefing, so the intelligence people could ask you all the questions, weather people could ask you how they predicted the weather, all about the fighters, the flak, mm-hmm. target damage, and what you saw, people bailing out of airplanes, that sort of thing.
And how long did the debriefing usually last?
It depend on, because you only had so many debriefers and you had how many crew, you had to wait sometimes for them. So if you got in right in the beginning, 30 minutes would take care of the debriefing period of time as you were under the gun with the intelligence people. Unless they wanted to collaborate something, and you said that the target looked like it damaged here and that, and I said, well, that crew over there said different, so let's stand aside, and when we get through, we'd like to get your crew with that crew and mm-hmm. see, break down who was right and who was wrong and anything like that.
And typically after the debriefing, what were your responsibilities then, Kenny?
Go back to your quarters and change clothes and
take
go,
a
to the bar.
Go to the bar. Oh, me. So you were off then until you had another mission.
And missions were very staggered because of the weather.
I noticed that you had quite a few, you know, skipped a day or only a day.
Well,
as
I've said, if they had enough airplanes and the weather was right, they'd have probably run us every day.
Yeah.
But they couldn't because of the weather. I mean, and therefore, there were some periods there where we had quite a little period of time mm-hmm. off. And if we did, the weatherman gave us a pretty good indication whether he thought there'd be mm-hmm. anything going on the next day or two.
Right.
Intelligence told us the same thing. We'd head for Cambridge or London.
So did you have the ability to get off base? Did you have an automobile or anything available to you? Or
no, we had.
Did you want to?
We had transportation to the railroad station mm-hmm. and get on the train. We rode trains into Cambridge, rode trains into London.
I see.
That's right.
Would you typically do that?
We didn't want to hang around too much.
You didn't stay around the base too much if you can get off. I can imagine that. Okay. Your missions, I want to cover a couple of them that I think might be of most memorable to you. If you could maybe just mention it.
Well, of course, I've said a little.
You'd like to cover all of them, but time.
I've said a little about the Saint-Nazaire mission, the low-level mission we tried Saint-Nazaire. I've already told you pretty much about that. And that was a real catastrophe. I mean, it really was. And I think when we came back from that, our morale and, we kind of thought in the back of our minds, what in the hell are those crazy generals up there thinking of anyway?
And that was only your second mission
The third mission. We went to San Jose twice in a row, mm-hmm. One from high altitude, one from low altitude. And, we said, look, I hope they don't try this again, because we didn't know whether they might try it again. But the word kind of filtered down that the intelligence that they were not going to try that again mm-hmm. anytime soon. And of course, we were all kind of anxious to get a German target. I mean, that was, after all, French targets were fine. We understood the strategic part of it, and submarine bases and rail junctions and that sort of thing. But what we were anxious to do, we're over here to do a job, and that's bomb Germany.
Right.
And I think the first target was Bremen, and that was a real thrill when we heard, when we got to the briefing room, we were told that we were going to bomb Bremen.
You were really excited about that.
Very excited. The crew members were excited, everybody in the room was excited, the General Ray was excited because he did all the briefing at the briefing meetings up there, the Bain briefings he did, talking about formations and that. And when he put that formations up there, the target was not uncovered, and he got everybody settled in their seats and talked about the formation and the weather to the target and this and that. And then he opened up the Bremen target, boy, he could, everybody cheered in the briefing room, boy, this is it. And I always remember Colonel Ray in that briefing. He said, gentlemen, yeah, here's what we came for. And here's what we're going to do. And the sooner we get this job done and bomb the rest of the German targets, the sooner we'll be able to invade Germany and end up committing all those atrocities they talk about. So you would put a little cool bill on that. Anyway, he laughed about it, and we all laughed. Well, we were gung-ho. We're going to bomb Germany today. Going to bomb Germany. But when we started looking at that map and saw the route to bombing Germany, it was all over France. Mm-hmm. We didn't go up over the North Sea and stay out of the way of the fighter. We were going to have fighters right all through. The way across and all the way back. And reality kind of settled in when you started thinking about all that.
I'm sure.
And I remember when the crew got together, the gunners, as I say, had their own individual briefing. And they had been briefed about fighters all across France. And they were a little more somber than we were, because they were more realistic. They knew their job was going to be tough. We took off that morning. It was about 8 o'clock, 8:30. I remember a lot about that mission. I remember that I was the flight leader of the group that day. I was going to lead the group my bombardier was going to be the group bombardier that day. We were not leading the old 8th Air Force Bomber Command. We were the third group in line. We weren't going to be tail end Charlie. Nobody liked to be tail end Charlie. That was the tail end group.
Right.
Because after the other two or three had been across, the Germans pretty well knew everything, and the fighters knew everything, and they'd had time to get up and down again, and you were going to get the full strength of the tail end Charlie. But we were not tail end Charlie, we were the third group that day. But we're leading our group, and I led defense, and I bet you got the big job. That day they did split us up. They sent the first two groups in ahead, and they would have their lead bombardier, and then we would come in with the third group, and our bombardier would be the lead of the second two groups. So I said, Vince, you got a big job today, buddy. He goes, well, I'm up to it. Fine. Okay. We all went out, stood around the airplane, and said, look, guys, here's what we came for. We're finally going to get our chance to turn German targets. And just remember, only one comes home today, it'll be us. Let's get in there and go. Well, took off fine, grouped fine, no problems. We had, and instead of having 18 airplanes, we had 16. Two did get off, or that's all that got off the ground for some reason or other. After they checked the airplane, they decided that something was wrong, I guess. Or did find out why they didn't know. Anyway, we only had 16 airplanes. And they formed up in different staggered wing groups because you couldn't have 3, 3, and 3. You had to have some cases, they put a box man in there, low, like a fourth man if he was left out of a group. And you had a couple of those situations on this particular run. Formation was great. We started over, started climbing immediately because we knew it was a long haul of climb. We were about a half hour into France when we started seeing our first fighters come up. And as I said, we really expected them sooner than that, but the British had come a little further into France that day. I guess they'd been told we were bombing Germany that day, and if they could give us any more protection. So they did. They stayed with us for about 15 minutes into France. Maybe that's the reason the fighters come up. I didn't come up. Anyway, they didn't come up while the Spitfires were around. And about 30 minutes into the target, here they came. We were about halfway to our altitude at that time. And climbing, the formation was good. And here came the fighters. I remember the first call out of fighters on that mission. 12 o'clock, coming in high, out of the sun. Yeah, I think the sun was right in our face. That's what they loved to do. Oh, yeah. So we couldn't hardly see them. Blind our gunners. Here they came. They hit the group, two groups up in front of us first, and came right on through them, and then came back up and came in about 1 o'clock. The top turret, top turret gunners started calling fighters at 1 o'clock. They were 109s, most of them. There were a few Messerschmitts, but two Focke-Wulfs, but most of them were Messerschmitts 109. We saw them hit the group, the squadron flight up to my right, which was another squadron, wasn't my squadron I was in, 324th. Hit them first and then came on over and came back up underneath, hitting up. One, they hit one airplane. We could see one airplane leave their formation and smoke coming out of his gun. I forget who called it. Either it was either my right waist gunner or my ball turret gunner said, plane out of control, going down slowly, not steep. And I asked if there were any parachutes. No, you're none yet. We went on. Got more reports on that airplane. They came in, they didn't hit us. They didn't hit my particular three airplane. They came on the flight below us, fortunately. And by that time we were, I guess, 45 minutes to an hour into France. They left us for a while, went on to the other group. And about an hour and 15 minutes, come give or take, because I wasn't timing it by the clock, timing how far the navigator told me we were from the target. The bombardier and navigator both called out fighters coming in on our flight. Top, I made some evasive action, climbed about 100 feet, made a left turn to give the ball turret a good sight on them, and the top turret gunner also, and the nose gunner, they couldn't do much shooting. Those bombardier and navigator guns up there, they did not do a lot of shooting. They just weren't very accurate. And that wasn't their main job anyway. We didn't hit any of them. They didn't hit us. They came on and swung around. My ball turret gunner said they went around and left, pulled up, shooting at a coming up speed from a flight on my left. Quiet for a while. About 15, 20 minutes later, we were about 30 to 40 minutes away from the target, according to my navigator. Here came some more. And these were 190s, mostly. My top turret gunner spotted them first coming out about 2 o'clock, coming in about 2 o'clock, formation of three of them. And he said, the chief said, they're coming right at us. Do something. Move, make a maneuver.
Do something.
I dove about 100 feet and swung around, turning into them so that my gunners would get a better aim at them, particularly the top turret gunner and the ball turret gunner, because they were coming in about 2 o'clock, and turned right into them, and they flew right by us. My top turret gunner said, I think I hit one of them, and I see some smoke coming out of him, the lead man. And the ball turret gunner said, I think you're right, Harold. I think you hit him. He didn't go down, but I think you hit him. He didn't hit us. We turned back, got on course again, and flew for another about 30 minutes. And Chuck said, Chief, we're about 15 minutes out from target area. Get lined up for target. I said, everybody okay? Let's get tight. Our gunners get in tight formation so the bombs will be accurate. And they pulled him real, real close. And Vince, I said, you going to be ready to take over? He said, I'll be ready when you say. Okay, you tell me when you got it first in your sights. Coming up on the edge of the target. And about 15 minutes, he said, got it, Chief, got it in sight, clear target, no clouds. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to you now. So I turned it over to him. I said, you got her, flyer. And he was about a minute out from the target at that time. And I sat there, biting my fingernail. And fighters had left us, no fighters. Black puffs, and of course, as is always said about flag, as long as you saw them, that was okay. It's when you didn't see them.
Okay.
We heard a couple of thumps underneath. We got some strikes. I said, you see anything down there, Scotty? He said, yeah, I think we got a hit just back of the ball turret, slight back, just under the waist gunner. And the waist gunner said, yeah, we got piece came up through there between here and the tail section, a couple of pieces. Okay, keep reporting to me, see if there's any damage. No major damage at this point. And still talking to myself and them too, waiting for Vince to say bombs away. And seemed like forever. The flak was still out there. We were flying through it. I said, well, you saw it, you didn't body. And the vet says, bombs away. Give me that airplane, Ben. It's yours, Chief. I said, make a big left turn here and pull up and fly. Here come the fighters, said the clock, top turret gunner. Fighters at 11 o'clock coming in. Okay, well, get them, get your ball. Get your guns on them, guys. Get them, get them, get them, get them. And Jim, help me get this thing in the airplane so we can get another little steep turn so Jim helped me control the airplane. And we turned around, got it 180 degrees, headed back home. Here came the fighters coming in. Any news on that? Any other airplanes being hit? Yeah, there's some in the upper echelon of the, I think it's the 324th, 323rd squadron, said Locke, and Winchell, the right waist gunner, said, yeah, said they're coming in from on that group, and they'll probably come through them and hit a kid coming through to us, it looks like. They didn't see any of them hit. Came through. Hit the right wing man. He's got some fire coming out of his number three engine. Okay, smoke, yeah. Is he leaving? Oh, he's still in formation. Okay.
Stop this.
This is an editor's note. End of tape A, side 2. The interview continues on tape B, side 1.
We're making a left turn off the target at Bremen and headed out on course back to England. And we started losing some altitude, and I was kind of concerned about that right wing man of the formation of flight of our, the right man of my flight who had been hit, to see if he was slowing down or had the full power. A little concerned about it, so I thought I didn't want to go too fast because he probably was losing power on that one engine. Still smoking. Still had it running though. He hadn't feathered the prop yet. Told Locke, who was top turret gunner, told him, said, watch him, Harold, because I'd like to know if he's has any trouble. Looks like he's falling behind. But we can slow down some as long as we keep a formation. So it didn't look like he was at first because we were dropping down about 400 or 500 feet a minute to get to lower altitude. Didn't see anybody else in our formation hit. There was two other groups who were up in front of us. It looked like they had lost one airplane. I couldn't count. I asked the co-pilot because I was too busy count the airplanes in their formation to see it. He said, well, it looked like one had gone from somewhere out of that formation. Looked like maybe they had one shot down. Of course, we couldn't watch our airplane. So here come the fighters. And they didn't come in as much from the front as we were leaving. They started coming in from the back, and the 3:30, 4 o'clock position, Locke was reporting them coming in from that angle as we were leaving, instead of coming in from the front. And of course, they were still coming out of the sun, which was hard on the gunner. They were leaving us alone pretty well. We weren't getting as much attack. We did get a couple of Focke-Wulf 190s came in. I remember they were called out by the top turret gunner. They were coming in at 3 or 4 o'clock. They saw the one that was smoking, and I presume they were trying to get him, hit him more, cripple him more. They obviously didn't, because we didn't see him have any more in. And it looked like his smoke was less. He must have pulled his extinguishers, got the fire out on that number 3 engine. It had now been feathered. There were also some 109s coming in from the left side at 9 o'clock, talking to from the left waist gunner. Again, he wasn't after our formation. He was after a group behind us, lower. We don't know whether they were trying to leave us alone or what, but we appreciated. They followed us all the way back to, we were about to 15 minutes from the English Channel, and they were right there, and then they turned and left. We couldn't count the formation. The formation was kind of breaking up there over the channel, which we normally did, so we could see who was hurt and who had engine trouble, who had wounded aboard or anything like that. They'd come in. We saw a couple of red flares, which from the group up ahead of us, which meant they had wounded and or bad mechanicals, so they could be landed first. So we kind of pulled back on our engines. My right wing man, he was still in formation with 3 engine. And we accessed damage. We found the guys told me that they'd seen a few flak holes up in the radio compartment, radio operator. Said nothing close to him, but they did come close. The tail gunner said that he had his head ducked at one time. He was down over his bomb, gun sight, and said something hit right up above where my head was before I put it down. Wow. He said, I've got a little thing to show you back here, Chief, when you get home. He'd been very lucky.
I would say.
Yeah. But, I know. I forgot about one thing over Bremen. We had some flak come up in the pilot's compartment over the underneath the co-pilot. Jim Varennes and put a piece of metal that thick in his seat. It's against regulations, but he'd done it. They said if everybody took extra flak, armament board, we would get off the ground. Anyway, I didn't even know it was under there. And he said he'd felt a thump under there, and sure enough, we got back to the base, showed the piece of flak had come up and hit that metal.
Oh, boy.
And it saved him a little embarrassment. But he had to take that out afterwards and found out.
Is that right?
Yeah, the colonel told him to take it out. Anyway, there was a bunch of people wounded and shot up. They all landed first. We came in, landed, went briefing, got to the briefing and found out that we really hit the Bremen, really hit the docks at Bremen, and everybody was just tickled to death. It looked like from the photography that we'd done a good job of bombing. Mm-hmm. We'd lost two airplanes out of the group, the first two groups. We didn't lose any out of my two groups that I was leading, but we lost out of the ones that had only 16 in there. They'd lost two, and of course they had two didn't get off the ground. Mm-hmm. Everybody was pleased with the first mission over Germany. We made an liar out of Hitler. We bombed Germany in daylight, and we were very happy about it.
I would say.
It's a good mission.
That was fascinating to hear you describe that, Colonel Morgan. Let me ask you a couple questions. I want to get to your last mission, but let me ask you a couple other questions about some things that I had. Now, you had metal helmets. When you went on your bomb run, when you expected flak, you wore a metal helmet, is that correct?
Yeah, you were allowed to wear it if you wanted to.
You were allowed to wear it. Optional. Did most?
Most of them did.
Most, yeah. Wear a metal helmet? And how about flak jackets? Did you have
flak jackets? We didn't get flak jackets. Those came afterwards. They had them on a voluntary basis, but they didn't have enough to go around, mm-hmm. as usual. And you could wear them if you wanted to. I never wore a flak jacket. Mm-hmm.
Did the B-17 have any armor on it in key points at all? It was subject to a bullet flying right through it then, in other words.
And if you've ever seen the metal on there, it's very thin.
Yeah.
Is this
how about your ability to keep warm at that altitude you were flying?
Well, of course, we didn't have a trouble up front. We had the pilot and co-pilot had heat in the cockpit, mm-hmm. manifold heat.
Oh, you had actual heat.
And of course, it top turret gunner was in the same compartment we were. He cut heat. And he also had some down in the nose of the down with the bombardier and the navigator. The four guys suffered with the guy in the back because they were wide open spaces.
Your waist gunners were had an open
radio
window,
operator
didn't they?
Had an open space above him, and the tail gunner wasn't open, but they wore electric suits.
Now, were they pretty reliable, these electric suits?
As long as the airplane was running.
Right, yeah, that's the other part. As long as the electrical was working.
Was working,
yeah. Let me ask you this. If a crew member, say a waist gunner, lost his glove for some reason or whatever, how long could you survive at that altitude?
I had a waist gunner that lost his glove, and he got frozen fingers. Mm-hmm. They had to nip, take off mm-hmm. tip of his cover of his finger.
So it would freeze.
Well,
pretty freeze. Fast.
Well, of course, particularly if that happened at your highest altitude, mm-hmm. It's 40 below zero.
Yeah. It's hard to imagine to me to have an open window as you're flying at those altitudes. It's just incredible. It really is.
They suffered, those guys.
Yeah, I would say. Let's. go to the final mission before your war bond tour, unless you've got something else you want to talk about.
Well, you want to do that, or you want to bring in William Wyler into this?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
The last mission where he was aboard?
Well, he was aboard on 5 missions.
Oh, he was? Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, William Wyler, Major William Wyler, who was a major in the Army Air Corps film unit, showed up at our base. I think it was on our 14th or 15th mission. First time I remember him being there. And of course, you film unit, we didn't know what the world he was doing there, what he was going
to
do.
Had he picked your crew?
Well, he hadn't yet.
Oh.
And he showed up and spent about a week there before we even met him in the mess hall and met him at the bar and knew him. He said he'd come over to do some filming for Army Air Corps film about strategic air bombing. It wasn't secretive, but he didn't talk much about it. And after he traveled around, met a lot of the crew members and this and that. And I always ask him later on if he ever checked out the records and all that to see who's who and what before he picked a crew to fly with. And he said, I did a little bit of checking. And anyway, I think the name Memphis Belle got to him. That kind of intrigued him because if you've seen some of the nose art, it was some strange nose art
right.
We had, and some of it wasn't too conducive to...
a little uncouth.
and he said, yeah, I looked at the nose art, looked around, saw you a flight leader and you had a pretty good record. And I said, weren't you disturbed that I was still the second lieutenant? All the rest of the flight leaders by this time were captains.
Right.
He said, no, that didn't bother me. He said, I heard you had a good rig. And he said, the Memphis Belle name kind of sparked me a little bit. So anyway, he came up to me one night while we were after mess. He said, I wonder if I could fly some missions with you and take some film. I said, if you've gotten permission from the Commander General and everybody else, as far as I'm concerned, you're welcome to, as long as you stay out of the other crew members' way. He said, I'll stay out of your way. I said, okay. So, I remember the first mission that we went to, he went with us on, it was again down to Saint-Nazaire. In fact, it was our last mission to Saint-Nazaire. And he did. He stayed out. He ran all of that dim airplane, and I always admired him because he had a camera in one hand and an oxygen bottle in the other, and he was just everywhere. But he didn't get in the gunner's way anywhere. He was taking film. You know, we didn't know what he was going to do with this film. But also, he did so that other people can get credit. He gave out 216-millimeter cameras to other crew members and said, on other airplanes, and said, look, if you're not too busy, would you mind just taking some film? I said, sure, if you're not busy. Sometimes the navigator wasn't busy, or bombardier wasn't busy until we got to the target. And some of the others weren't too busy shooting. So he got an awful lot of film. And he did a nice gesture after thing was all over. He gave the 16-millimeter cameras to these people. He also had an associate that flew on some other airplane and took film too, but he was the main man. He was the director, and he was supposed to make this movie. And he said he was very quiet about what he was going to be doing with it. He said, and we all thought, you know, kind of second-guessed him.
I said, make sure your film doesn't run out of
it. I grabbed a camera.
Yeah, we kind of second-guessed him and said, well, it's going to be a training film and take back. But the guys at the training get an idea what combat's about. I said, if they see all this, they won't even want to come over here. But well, we kind of guessed what it was going to be about. Anyway, so he flew 5 missions. And just a gentleman at all times, and I said I admired him. And, you know, again, we didn't know after the 5th mission any more than we did the first. Because he will tell you a little secret later on, we get to our 25th mission. As I said, we made it to 25 missions, obviously. We were very, very lucky. And I want one point cutting across. We were no better crew than any of those other crews. In bombers, you had to fly formation. You couldn't do any rash maneuvers, particularly a flight leader. And we were just very, very fortunate. We were all trained the same. We all were just as good as the other. But I lost my right wing man twice, I lost my left wing man once, and we still came home. I can't figure anything but fate or luck or whatever you want to call it. We were just very, very fortunate. Because the other guys were just as good as we were. That's the way bomber crews were. Mm-hmm. You stayed in formation, you did your job. Right. Anyway, we had a lot of damage to our airplane. We told you we lost all those engines, we had part of the right wing shut off, we had hundreds of flak holes in the airplane. And only one crew member hurt. Slightly, it was D. John Quinlan got a piece of flak. And he was so little, he didn't even want to take the Purple Heart, they made him take it, because if you get wounded, you've got to take the Purple Heart. So he took it. And again, how lucky can you be? We went through 25 missions. Our last mission was not at Wilhelm's Island.
I know.
It was at Lorient.
Yes, right.
And there were no easy missions, but this was an easier mission than any of the others. And that again is his fate. We got a few holes in the airplane from flak. A couple of fighter shots at, through the left wing, but we still made it over there. My squadron commander at that time, new squadron commander, because I was going to shut in, was so confident that we were going to make that 25th mission, he went with us. William Wilder did not go on the 25th mission.
Oh, he didn't go.
The Air Corps, for propaganda purposes, wanted the 25th mission to be a German target, not a French target.
I see.
Public relations, propaganda,
right.
Everything. So they used the 24th mission, which is the Wilhelmshaven, right? And called it the 25th mission. And William Wilder was on that mission. But that's
story behind the story.
Nothing wrong with, nothing wrong with that. That's, we still went on 25th mission and came back. And of course, when we saw the English Channel coming back and the wife flew us to Dover, we knew we had it made. And the guys were all hollering and hooping and yelling over the intercom. And we're going home and all that. And we came in and of course, Colonel Ray let me buzz the field.
Is that the shot that you have of about 20 feet off the deck coming home?
Yeah.
That's a great
and
shot.
And they also did another little public relations thing. When they knew that we were okay, we didn't have any problems, no major damage, they made us sit out there and wait until all the other planes had landed so they could get this shot and let us buzz the field and all that. So we had to sit out there and wait to come in. We were the last plane to land. And they filmed it pretty well. And when we landed, of course, we knew we were going home, but then that's when William Wilder, who was on the ground that day, he didn't fly, came up to me and said, Bob, got news for you. I said, what's that, Bill? He said, this filming we made, it's going to be a documentary, and we're going to call it The Memphis Belle. And I said, so what? We're going home. That's the only thing that matters. And then I thought a minute, I turned around and said, Bill, what would happen if we got shut out on our 25th mission? He said, oh, we had that covered. We had a backup. I said, you did? He said, yeah. And then I learned later that Hell's Angels, pilot had finished 25th mission, and the airplane was going to finish 25 minutes, so they would have used
Hell's
Angels as the documentary.
Instead of Memphis Belle. That's interesting sidelight to that. Very interesting. Well, now, when you were out on the field, when did the king and queen came, right? Or was that later, or was that all part of the same arrival from that 20th?
That was later.
That was later, oh, okay. In the documentary, it looks like it's the same time.
No. Well, it is. That's at another time, right. Really. But you see, that was the 17th of May. We didn't come home till the 6th of June. Mm-hmm. We had all that time in between, which they were building up propaganda and public relations and the king and queen deal and the generals coming and telling us and giving us our DFC. And then the generals coming and tell us goodbye. Mm-hmm. All that propaganda was building up. You know.
During that, after your mission, till the time you came back. They used that to take a lot of additional footage.
The media was building it up too. They were going to build it up for a big homecoming and all that. And since we were going to fly the airplane back to the States, and they wanted to give William Wyler time to get that documentary to California so we could be ready for it when we got back to the States to do the audio. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of propaganda built up. Because that's when the generals told us we were going home on our 26th mission.
Right.
And that was our most important mission. We were going to go back and thank the American public for what they were doing, and civilians, what they were doing, and all that. So we were ready. And we flew back.
Describe what happened to you at that point on your 26th mission.
Oh, well, we flew back across the North Atlantic. Landed at Iceland to get refueled, came back, and the first official stop, we stand on top of Westover Field just to refuel and clean up. First official stop was Washington National Airport, mm-hmm. where General Arnold was going to meet us, and the Secretary of State, other high officials. And I remember that distinctly because we were going to meet all these officials and everything and start this tour. I called in with Washington National for landing instructions. The tower gave them to me. And they said, but before you land, General Arnold has ordered you to buzz the field.
Hmm.
I thought, well, that's it. I said, repeat that. He said, ordered you to buzz the field. I said, thank you. And old Washington Airport at that time had a balcony where all the dignitaries right. and people watched planes come in and out. That's where General Arnold and all of them were. And I headed right for them. And they ducked. But when I landed, General Arnold came over and congratulated us all. Came up to me and said, Morton, very seriously. I said, that was one hell of a buzz job. Then he told me, he said, and he whispered in my ear, he said, you can buzz any place you want to while you're on this tour. So we had a ball for 26 missions.
So how long did the...
3.5 months.
3.5 months.
32 cities.
Typically, what did you do? Did you
fly to the city? Most places where there were factories or somewhere which was making military goods, we would walk through the factory and we'd make speeches to the group that would assemble out in front. And each crew member would say something. And I would introduce each one of them. And we would thank them and, you know, tell them what a heck of a job they were doing. Keep it up and we'd get this war won. And then, of course, we were wined and dined and all that.
Did you meet a lot of dignitaries and high-profile people, I assume?
Yeah, we did. And, of course, we also got to go, Asheville was one of our stops. They let us come here in New Haven, where the co-pilot was one of our stops. And they tried to make stops close, couldn't make stops to all 10 crew members, but they made them too close to their hometown so that they could get family out and people from friends and all that.
Right.
So we got to hit all those kind of places, and we went to couple of air gunnery schools where they were training gunners in 17, and flight schools where they were training B-17 pilots. And We met a lot of people and had a lot of fun. It was tiring. We made two or three speeches a day.
Yes.
We had a, as I said, we were wined and dined and treated royally. Oh, I forgot to tell you one thing, and I hope I can back up.
Sure.
Halfway through my tour of 25 missions, after my squadron commander had been shot down and he had different squadron commanders temporarily, they were going through some of his papers that the squadron commander had shot down, and they found two promotions for me, one for first lieutenant and one to captain. And a note from General Olds that he would appreciate if they were delayed. So he'd been stuck in the desk door. And halfway through, they voted me 1 week to first lieutenant and next week to captain. So I came back to the States captain. So the reason it made me think about this, well, one of the stops on tour was Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And while we were there talking to the crowd, a gentleman came up and tapped me on the shoulder, and I looked around, and there was General Olds, and he had a big grin on his face. He said, "Morgan, I got to undo it. You pinned my major's leaves on me." So that was kind of a...
Oh, that's great. That's great. So anyway, anything else you want to talk about on your tour?
Well, we went to Memphis, of course.
Okay.
And we had quite a crowd there, and we had a big show there. They had a P-51 and a P-47 greet us, and we tried to do all the maneuvers they did. We put on quite a show in Memphis. We were really written up as fighter bomber.
Was Margaret Pope part of that?
Margaret Pope, the media had built up this relationship with Margaret Pope. Matter of fact, they practically had us married before we got back to the States, because it was a good story. They thought it was a wonderful story. We were in Cleveland, in Ohio. We went there too, and I had worked for the Dressograph Motograph Corporation in Cleveland for a very short period of time when I went into the service. And so they had a big to-do about that. And they flew Margaret in with her mother from Memphis, and unsurprised, I didn't know she was going to fly in there. So she was a big surprise there. So she was there, and she was in Memphis. And, you know, we corresponded all the time during our European tour. And she had ridden me, and I had ridden her, and we had quite a romance going. But when we got back and things kind of got hectic with the 26 mission we were on and all that, and I had, on the 26th mission, one of the stops was Wichita, Kansas. And while I was in Wichita, a General Wolf came up to me and said, "Morgan, would you like to see a new plane, a new bomber?" I said, "Yes." I said, "Well, we've got one here I know you haven't heard about." Took me over to the hangar and showed me the B-29, and got up in it, got in the cockpit, and it was so big compared to 17. I said, "This is a nice airplane, I'd like to fly that." He said, "Well, after you get through this 26th mission, and you leave at home, and all that, if you're still interested, give me a call." And so I got to thinking about that. I knew where they were going to take it, because they hadn't built that long-range bomber to go to Europe, no question about it. Built it to go to Japan. And General Arnold had told all of us in Washington, said, "Look, when you guys get through with the tour around, get your leave," said, "just let the," we had a captain with us that flew with us out of the Pentagon, public relations officer, said, "just tell Captain Winkle here who, what you want to do, and I'll approve it. So you guys can pick out anything you want."
Let's stop right here.
Second. I was also trying to tie that in, because when we were told that we could have any job we wanted, and I decided I was going to go on the B-29 program, I called General Wolf after I finished tour duty, I mean the 26th mission, and leave at home. He said, well, what would you like? I said, I'd like my own squadron of B-29. He said, granted. He said, I've already been told by General Harlan to give you whatever you wanted. So we started training in late 43 in Pratt, Kansas. I trained with a group that I was not going to go overseas with, but just to get familiarization with the 29 and some idea, because they were halfway through their training and they were not going to, well, they were going to CBI, 58 bomb wing. So I trained with them in Pratt, then they took off and left, and they left me with one B-29. It was kind of funny. Well, they didn't have any B-29, so they gave me one B-29 and a crew just to play around with and fly. Sent me down to Clovis, New Mexico to practice down there in the heat and the sandstorms and all that. Why, I never figured out. But since I'd chosen B-29 and going to the Pacific again, this upset Market Polk. Rambo said I was going back to combat. He said, look, you don't have to go to combat. And well, I said, you know, I've got a job to do, I still think. And we kind of said, well, let's part as friends and that. So we didn't carry our romance on. The rest of my crew members of Memphis Belle thought I was crazy when I said I was going 29.
You already had your 25 missions. Yeah,
and they said, what in the world are you going to? Well, I had three reasons. I didn't think I wanted to step behind a desk the rest of the war, the Pentagon, or anything like that. Go to the training command, and one of those young kids would get me killed in the damn training command. But I had another reason. I had a little bit of revenge at Pearl Harbor. And I'll admit it was revenge. And I had a payback that I wanted to go. So that's really why I, you know. So anyway, we started accumulating people coming. We went back to Pratt, Kansas, accumulated our group, my squadron, and the 497th Bomb Group started to form. Little by little, we started getting some B-29s and started training out there. We had a little trouble with B-29 in the very beginning, and even a little bit of combat. They built that airplane so fast, in such a big hurry, and they built put that big engine on there. They didn't properly cool it, and it would overheat if you had any ground time at all. So we even had to train in. We'd taxi out with only two engines running, and then start the other two engines just before we take off. So we'd have two cool engines anyway. We lost some engines. We didn't lose any airplanes in training. But we had to make a few emergency landings with it. But we formed our crew. I didn't have any of the other crew members of the Memphis Belle that were very anxious to go with me. They all turned me down, except about halfway through our training in Pratt, Kansas, I got a telephone call one day from my bombardier, Vince Evans. He was training bombardiers in Victorville, California. And called me up and said, you got any space there in your squadron for a good bombardier? I said, why, Vince? He said, well, Fisk was quite a ladies' man. And he'd been married a couple of times. And it seems that his last marriage, not his last marriage, but his previous marriage, he failed to get a legal divorce. And he'd gotten married again, and so he had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I need to leave the country for a while. So I went down to my squad group commander. I said, Colonel Ray. Went to the colonel and I said, look, I got a bombardier, and it's the best bombardier that you'll ever get. I'd like to transfer to my squadron. And he said, really? I said, yeah. He said, well, if you can work it out, you got more pull in the Pentagon than I have. So go ahead. I called this captain of the Pentagon. I told him the story. Said, no problem. I said, I'll take care of it. And so Colonel Wright, my squadron commander, called me down again 2 days later. He said, had a piece of paper in his hand. He said, you know, I've been in this military and Army Air Corps for 15 years. I've never seen anything like this in my life. Normally when they transfer a man, they transfer him from one Air Force to the other Air Force, to the other Air Force, finally gets to the Air Force that's in the training command. But this is direct from Victorville to your 324 squadron. And that's not military. That's not the way it's supposed to be done. So I told him the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
He laughed. He said, doesn't bother me if it doesn't bother the Pentagon. So he was transferred to me, went overseas with me. We had, in October of 1944, we flew our squadron, our group, to Saipan and the Marianas. Stop in San Francisco, stop in Kwajalein. And we were I was the second B-29 to land on Saipan. General Possum Hansel was the first. I was really there before he was, but he got permission to land for one to publicity.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so he landed there. We were the second one. And the island hadn't been completely taken. They still had some Jap fighting up on the north end of the island. But the Marines done a heck of a job. And the CB's done a great job building it, 7,000-foot runway. And we got there in October and started doing a little practice mission around a few islands that didn't have any people on them and dropping a few bombs. Finally, General Rosie O'Donnell, who was a 73rd Wing commander who was over our group, called me on the telephone, said, Morgan, we're going to bomb Japan tomorrow. This was the 23rd of November. Yes, sir, I said, I'd heard the rumor. We hadn't been briefed yet. He said, yeah. He said, I'd like for you to lead this raid. I said, well, General, you know, you can pick anybody you want to. He said, but I want to go along with you as command pilot. Is that all right with you? I said, that's fine. I have no problem with that. So on the 24th of November, he took off Saipan. 73rd Wing, it was the only wing operating. Tinian hadn't gotten their airplanes yet and their crews. Guam hadn't gotten theirs yet. 73rd Wing was the only operating, and it had three groups in it. And we took off, daylight bombing, 29,000 feet. We bombed Tokyo. Did a lousy job bombing. Somebody had forgot the fact that there are very strong jet winds in that area. And over 200 miles an hour winds at 29,000 feet. Poor bombardier, even with the Norden bomb sight, he had a heck of a time. Anyway, we bombed, we did lose an airplane that day from enemy. We lost one from mechanical, had to ditch in the ocean. All got back to Saipan, probably. And we started bombing Japan, different targets. Again, done a lousy job bombing. Japanese fighters were kind of at the bottom of the barrel. They had a little trouble getting up to high altitude. We got a few kamikaze attacks. Their flak was not near as accurate as the German. We got some hits. We lost a few airplanes. But the bombing was so bad, Washington was just completely disturbed. They have to do something. So they did. They made the change of generals. They brought General Possum Hansel back to Washington. And set over, as far as I'm concerned, the greatest military Air Corps general who had done World War II, General Curtis LeMay. And I knew when I heard he was coming that things would happen, because he'd already proven in Europe that formation flying and other things, that when he was going to do a job, it was going to be done no matter what it took to get it done. And I understand he came to Guam and take over his headquarters. He said, gentlemen, told them we're going to do some different things up there. And the things he wanted to do, he didn't tell us about at the beginning, I mean, before. He came up to Saipan and briefed us, 73rd Wing, bombardiers, pilots, and navigators. And I always remember it too, because he sat there and he said, gentlemen, had that cigar in his mouth, not lit, didn't smile. And I thought he didn't smile because of the fact that he just didn't smile. But I found out after the war, he had a situation in his face, and it was tied together, and he couldn't smile. But he said, we're going to do something different tonight. We're going in at night, and we've never done a night bomb. Mm-hmm. Going to bomb at night. We're going in not at 29,000 feet. The highest group would be at 6,000 feet. And the other thing new, we're going to use a new bomb. Tape bomb, jelly bomb, fire bomb, whatever you want to call it. And believe me, this fire, this will burn in on anything. And you don't need any type formations. You can be as loose as you want to. Come in one right after the other and bomb. And we'll just fly over in general formation. And he said, I always remember one thing he said. He said, I asked General Arnold to let me lead this mission. He turned me down. Pilot in the way in the back of the briefing room said, stood up and said, sir, you can have my position right now. Everybody started to laugh. It kind of got the chality into it. Anyway, we went over there the 6th of March, 1945, and we bombed Tokyo at night. I always remember we got in sight of Japan. It was still lit up, they hadn't turned the lights out or anything in Tokyo. My bombardier called me up, called me Chief. He said, Chief, this is going to be a duck soup. I've been in problems there. We just let these bombs out right over the center of the lights. So we did. We went in one right after the other. We didn't fly formation. We just went right in, one after streamlined, bombed the city. And over the next 2 weeks, we burned out 54 square miles of Tokyo. And as I've said, Japanese didn't resign then, so they weren't going to quit, so we had to drop the time, bottom line. I want to bring a couple of things in about the trips over. It was 15-hour trips, long haul. That was the worst part about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We lost a few airplanes to enemy action. We lost a few airplanes to mechanical. We had great cooperation with the Navy. They stationed submarines on the Marianas up. Call them Dumbos. If you got in trouble and had to ditch, you'd radio them, and one of the quickest nearest to them would try to get to you, pick you up. And they picked up quite a few. But even more important, the taking of Saipan. I've always thanked every Marine I ever met. That was the greatest job in the world. At the cost they did it, but they took that island. It saved over 100 B-29s that landed there that couldn't have gotten back and had to ditch in the ocean.
Turn tape now.
Editor's note. End of tape B, side one. The interview continues on tape B, side two.
Had to ditch.
It had to, would have had to ditch in the ocean. Over hundreds of them landed there, got prepared, went on back to the Marianas. I happened to be one of those. I lost two engines over Tokyo one night, and could never have made it back. I landed Iwo Jima, I changed the engine, came on. So I have to thank them. I finished 25 missions over there, and General Rosie O'Donnell called me and said, "Don't you think it's about time you went home or your luck runs out completely?" "Yes, sir, I'm ready." So he sent me back to the States.
Your mission to Tokyo was the first mission since Doolittle's raid. Is that right? Your first mission? And then your firebombing mission was the first firebombing mission over. And you led that raid, yes. Did you not?
Well, nobody led it.
Oh, that's right.
One by one.
One by one. Were you number one?
We were up front.
You're up front.
Yeah. So. I don't think we were the first one all the time.
Right. Close to. Fascinating. Let me ask you a couple questions of from the time that you, General O'Donnell, suggested maybe you might want to go home. You did go home within a few weeks of that. And at that time, did you go to a training command somewhere?
Well, they sent me down to Hunter in Savannah. Uh-huh. They were training B-29 crews.
I see.
And I was just going to be kind of overseas to help train them to be 29. I didn't really have a job for me, so that's what I said.
And how long were you in the service then from that point on?
Well, of course, I came home in June 45, and late May and first part of June. And of course, I dropped the atomic bomb in August.
Right.
And I went and wanted to get out of active duty. They wanted me to stay in active. I didn't want to stay in active. And the main reason I wasn't that military. I mean, I love to fly, but I was not that military. And I could see myself making a life career out of military. So I went to Fort Bragg, got my separation papers, and then I rejoined the reserve. Stayed in the reserve in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
But the regular military wasn't for me. I'm glad I didn't play it.
Did you come back to Asheville then?
Oh, yeah.
At that point?
My father had furniture business here, mm-hmm. in Asheville. And I seriously considered going in the airlines.
Mm-hmm.
My bombardier turned out to be a good friend of Howard Hughes,
mm-hmm.
who owned TWA, Transworld Airlines.
Right.
And he offered me a job of his assistant chief pilot. And I very seriously considered. My dad wanted me to come to first one so bad. So I finally made a decision. I made a deal with him. I said, if the company would buy an airplane, have a corporation airplane, I'd come back work for them. So we got an airplane out of it.
I see. So you continued on then in the furniture business
here? After my father died, and my brother and I didn't agree on how the furniture business would be run, so we sold the three plants, two of them to Drexel and one to Ethan Allen.
I see.
And got out before we ruined them.
And then you went into the real estate
business? Well, no, I had a very interesting, I had a Volkswagen dealership too.
Oh, you did?
Between.
Volkswagen.
Yeah. I laughed about it because I went to Germany a number of times,
right.
The factory, and I always got kidded over there. Of course, I got along with them real well. I met a lot of German pilots that flew against us. One I had lunch with who was at St. Nazaire on the same mission I was on my third St. Nazaire mission.
Yeah, right.
We had a big laugh about that. We didn't shoot him down, he didn't shoot us down.
But that's ironic that you would have a Volkswagen dealership after trying to blast them out of the existence. That's something. Well, let me ask you a couple other questions here. I think you've already alluded to the ability of the, or maybe the capability of the Japanese to conduct war at the time you were bombing.
They were getting to the bottom of the barrel.
They were having a difficult time.
They were desperate.
And you could tell by the
attack,
you didn't have the fighter opposition that you obviously.
And their planes weren't like the 109 and a 190, yeah. Zero and nothing.
What was your opinion of the enemy that you were facing at the time? I assume you had a great deal of respect for your enemies from their capabilities.
Are you talking about which enemy?
Either Germany or both.
Well, Germany, of course, I had a lot of respect for the Germans. I mean, they were engineering-wise, airplane-wise, equipment-wise, they were so far advanced, and they were ahead of us until we got to P-51 in there. We didn't have a fighter compared to the Germans. The British had a Spitfire, they compared. But
from a standpoint,
crew, myself,
yeah, if possible, would love to. Did you, of course, you were in the heat of battle in over Germany. Did you have occasions where you became aware of the psychological stress that men were under and the effect on them?
But
any personal
in our particular phase of it, there were two different phases. It was our phase and then the phase of 6 months after we left when they had fighter escort. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to pilots that went through that. And that, I mean, it was still tough, but they had fighter escort. Mm-hmm. And we felt the odds against us were so great. You know, if we kept on without fighter escort, it was going to be losing battle. So that was our particular phase. We had guys that had to step down. There were pilots, there were other crew members that had to step down and just got to them.
Wow. Tell me about your opinion of the movie The Memphis Belle. Cy Harrington said, be sure and ask him that question. So
everybody asks me.
I'm sure everybody does.
Well, the first thing you've got to remember is the documentary that was made in combat, made by William Wyler. The movie, one of the co-producers of that movie, was William Wyler's daughter, Catherine Wyler. She had been wanting to make a full-length movie of the Memphis Belle or that type of movie. She was not trying to duplicate her father. It was, as a matter of fact, before they ever got to approving the movie to make it, it was going to be called The Southern Belle.
Oh.
It was going to be called. The smart people in Hollywood said, look, we've got to, what we call it, The Memphis Belle, and get us off the head start. Publicity we've gotten already, we'll sell more tickets. Turned it and called it The Memphis Belle. They didn't bother to tell people this, but this was not supposed to be our 25th mission. It had already been done in the video. This was a composite of different things that happened to different crews on different missions and put it all into one mission.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did. The technical advisor for that movie was Roger Freeman, who wrote The Mighty Eighth, the best historical book that's ever been written on the 8th Air Force. And Roger assures me that he can document every combat piece of action, mm-hmm. combat, I underline that took place, that happened to some crew. So it's realistic, because from that standpoint, but not from a Memphis Belle crew airplane
right.
standpoint. The way they had the crew acting was terrible.
I thought so too.
They glamorized it. They let them argue. We were all business. We couldn't have acted. I mean, other crew members of B-17s and B-24s, they see that movie, they hold their head when they come out. No way in the world. They didn't want to be shown in that way.
Right.
And that is why they did not use the real crew members' names in the movie. Because Hollywood lawyers told them they might get sued by one of the crew members for using, displaying them in that particular case. And they might have.
Did anybody contact you about the movie prior to the film?
Catherine Wilder got in touch with me. She was with Columbia Pictures for years. Pretty big in Columbia Pictures. And while she was there, the script was written for Memphis Belle. She sent me a copy of the script. I read it, sent her back about 10 pages of what I thought was wrong with it, which I found out they didn't pay attention to. And Columbia Pictures had an upheaval out there. Japanese came and took over. She was out. She took it to Warner Brothers. And they said they'd make it. So it was a lot before ahead of time. Incidentally, the money to make that movie, a third of it was Japanese money, a third of it was U.S. money, a third of it was English money.
Japanese money went to it. Amazing. Okay. Can you characterize your service in just briefly what you thought about what you did?
That's just damn lucky.
Damn lucky. Well, I guess that sums it up, huh?
No, I mean, you know, yeah, I look back. Sometimes when I'm not around at air shows or something, and I come in here and look at, see some of those airplanes, see the Memphis Belle airplane, and that. Or sometimes after I show the documentary quite a lot. People call me up and ask me, schools and things like right. that. And it gets shown on public TV a lot. It gets on the Discovery Channel. Recently it was on one of the channels, public or
yes,
Discovery
it was.
Or something.
Sure was.
I get a call usually when it's on. And somebody says, don't you want to look at it? It's on. I said, I got it up here. I don't want to have to look at it.
Right. You don't have to look at it.
You know, sometimes I actually come to the point, did I dream all this, or did it really happen?
I can believe that.
I mean, how in the world could I go through combat tour duty in Europe, and a combat tour duty in the Pacific, and come out with no physical damage that I can show? And all these other guys, these guys, buddies of mine that I ate dinner with, went to the London with, what pubs with, played cards, poker with, they didn't make it. How come me? You know? I know better than that. And the worst part about it was the closest I came to getting killed was a civilian airplane.
Well, I probably imagine how you're going to answer this, maybe, but how did it change your life?
It changed my life two different directions. One is not good. I came back. I got so much publicity immediately after the war. Came back to Asheville. I was Asheville's fly boy. Done all that. Everybody couldn't. I don't, couldn't do enough for me and all that. And I think I was able to accept that reasonably well. On the other hand, for the first few years I came back, I lost 5 years, basically. Mm-hmm. 5 years that John Doe here didn't lose, my brother who didn't end up in combat or didn't end up in the military. And I was a little resentful for that. So I decided I'm going to make up for those 5 years. So I had a good time. I played a lot. I worked hard. My dad and brother both say I worked hard, but I played awful hard. Until I finally woke up and said, look, you're going to be a good businessman, a good Christian, or you're going to play for the rest of your life. And so for a few years there, it changed my life a lot. Then, it kind of got changed again after my wife died. And met Linda, the minute I got married. You know, the Memphis Belle movie coming out again, even though by name, 1990. It started getting publicity, and people asked me to come to premieres and all this, that, and other, and get copies of the movie and show it. And I did it. I went to schools, studying World War II history, started inviting me again to come over and show the original documentary and talk about that other movie. And then Linda came. And Linda had been in public relations, aviation, for years. She knew Paul Tibbetts before I did. I mean, I knew Paul during the war, but I didn't know him after the war. We never got together after the war. She met other guys. She did public relations for him. It was an airplane. The original airplane that flew the movie Bell, the last one. Yes, they were flying out of the country, showing off, doing the show. She went to work for him in public relations. Pre-visit planning and all that. And then we met at the Sun and Fun Air Show. And we got married. And she said, look, why don't we do some public relations and go around these air shows and this, that, and that. Well, like a long story short, we've been going ever since. And we did about 25 shows last year. We did 30 shows, been to England, been to Japan 3 times as their guest.
Is that right?
As their guest, mind you.
That's the best way to go.
Well, they told me to talk about the Memphis Belle, but don't talk about the Dauntless Titan. They let me know they didn't want to hear about it.
They didn't want to hear about Dallas. That's very interesting.
I've been to England 3 times. I've been 6 times. Linda and I have been 3 times.
Well, my brother sent me the article about your visit up in Fredericksburg.
Oh, did he?
In fact, I've got it out in the car. He clipped it out of the newspaper and sent it
back. You mean the one in the Washington Post wrote?
Yeah, I think it was in the Washington Post. Yeah,
that's a nice article.
It shows you a picture with your arm around an individual.
That's a B-24 pilot too. That's the funny part about it.
Yeah,
he and I kid each other about the two airplanes.
And interestingly enough, you know that those two aircraft, the Collins Company, I believe it is, that owns those planes, they were down in Shiloh, North Carolina, just Shiloh Airport, just I think a week before they were up there. And I went down.
I flew that airplane when I was up there.
That's what I understand.
Yeah. I've flown, there's 13 flying, and I've flown 7 out of the 13.
Is that right?
And I recently flew the B-1. I guess you heard about that.
No, man.
Didn't you? Oh, that's about the thrill of my lifetime.
Yes, it is.
I just flew the B-1.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You ever see Chuck Yeager and so forth?
Bring Chuck Yeager came up to my wife.
What's that?
Chuck Yeager's name. Oh, okay. Can't stand. Yeah, I know Chuck.
Is there anything you'd like to conclude with, Colonel Martin, before we...
No, the big thing that I'm trying to do, particularly when I go around these high schools, I find that they don't teach World War II history. Not only don't they teach the whole picture, but they don't teach the aviation part. They don't tell these guys what aviation did for that war. And these kids have no idea. Until they see something like Collins airplanes, they don't know what a World War II airplane is. Right. But when they hear from me and other people, because I'm not the only one who goes around and speaks, they get the picture, and the questions they ask is so interesting. And if they need to know they're living today because of what World War II did, and not only because of the military teether.
Right.
The civilians did it too. The whole country did it. There was one time that everybody was behind the project.
Right.
The war. Every time. 100%. And that's what these kids did today.
Sure it is.
Private Ryan is probably the greatest movie at that point from the grandstand, and every
fantastic
high school student should be demanded to see that.
Absolutely.
And he is thinking about making an air movie.
Oh, gosh, I can hardly wait. Okay, anything else, Bob, before we conclude this?
I don't think so. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, this has been great being here with Colonel Robert K. Morgan, pilot of the Memphis Belle and Dauntless Dottie, and look forward to seeing you again in the future sometime.
It's my pleasure.